Well, here we are again, another episode of Life in the Peloton. I'm pleased to have my co-host on here, Lionel Burney from the Cycling Podcast. Welcome, Lionel, to another episode.
Hi, Mitch. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, actually. I've been a good dad at the moment. I've had plenty of time at home, and that is probably one of the biggest positive sides at the moment to the controversy of what's going on around the world and also inside the small cycling bubble, the coronavirus, which has sort of turned everything up on its head, and especially in the cycling world. If anyone doesn't know about it, you know, a lot of the Italian races, well, all of the Italian races for the next month have been cancelled. And I was due to go down to Strada Bianchi on the weekend, and instead I was at home having a weekend with the family, which was nice on the other side.
Well, tell me what actually happened, because your team, EF Pro Cycling, were really proactive on this issue. Jonathan Vaughters, the team boss, had been on Twitter kind of talking about, you know, how, you know, the show must go on. And I got the sense that he kind of got educated a little bit on the situation with this virus. And then within probably 48 hours, the team had pulled out of the Italian races and was kind of leading the way. Certainly wasn't the only team to pull out of the Italian races, and also Paris-Nice. And then, of course, the Strade Bianche, Tirreno, Adriatico, Milan-San Remo, all cancelled, hopefully will be rescheduled later in the year. But as a rider, all set to go, your bag presumably packed, ready to catch a flight. How did things play out for you?
I think, look, I'm not exactly sure how the final decision came with the team, but I guess it was just a hell of a lot more to lose than to gain by going down there with the whole team, everyone flying from different parts of Europe across into Italy. And with everything that was going on there, not knowing exactly what was going on, I think it was the right decision to make that call, opposed to getting there and then finding out, oh, we should have made this call before we got here. And I really love that the team was on the front foot there and made that decision, because it sort of took it out of my hands and the decision was made. I actually had just finished my last sort of push for Strade Bianche and was ready to rock and roll, had a couple of cruisy days and then into the race. But unfortunately, once that call had been made, I was like, well, it looks like I've got a big block of training again on the weekend. It's time to push on. So that was difficult motivation-wise, to suddenly then go out and kill yourself in training when you're expecting to be riding up the dirt roads in Italy and something exciting, which I was really looking forward to. But on another side of things, you know, I'm safe at home, and like I said, I got to have another weekend with the family, so I definitely wasn't complaining on that side of things.
So tell me about this episode of Life in the Peloton. This is you and your old mate Luke Durbridge back together again.
Yeah, we're back together. This is a classics review. I love having a chat with Luke, and we have a few cheeky Belgian beers and discuss the opening weekend in Belgium. And for anyone who doesn't know, this is the first weekend of the classics, the Belgium classics that begin with Umloop Het Nieuwsblad and then the following day, Kerner Brussels Kern. They're so stressful. Everyone's ready to go. Everyone's ready to show what they've done over the winter. This year, I wasn't up there, so it was awesome sitting on the other side of the table talking to Durbo about it and just going, mate, was it just as stressful as it always is? And just waiting to hear those answers, because the weather was horrible. The racing looked tough, and I was just loving talking to him from an outside point of view. Last year, we talked about it because we were both in the race. This year, I wasn't there, so it was even more interesting for me to interview him about that. And following that, we got some great listener questions sent in and some funny moments there. Durbo and I, after our second beer, were starting to get a little bit more loose, and the questions were really flowing well. So I hope everyone enjoys everything, all the answers out there, and our review of the classics, because listening back myself, I certainly enjoyed listening to it.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, radio tour at the Tour de France, of course, interrupting this episode to remind me to tell you that Life in the Peloton is this week sponsored by Velo Birmingham and Midlands, who organise a closed road sportive, and this year will also be hosting the prestigious HSBC UK Road Race Championships. So from the 18th to the 20th of June, the National Championships will be taking place in the Midlands, with the best British riders all battling for the gold medals and the national champions' jerseys white with the red and blue bands in the time trials and the road races.
And the following day, that's Sunday the 21st of June, up to 15,000 riders will ride on closed roads over 45 miles or 100 miles. Velo Birmingham and Midlands is billed as Britain's second biggest closed roads cycling event. And with the National Championships tagged on this year, it's an even more attractive proposition. In fact, the sign-on and start area of the National Championship road races is adjacent to the Velo Birmingham and Midlands rider registration point, which means that people, when they go to sign on for the Sunday Sportive, they can see the riders from the National Championships, the professional riders in the flesh, and also watch the road races on the big screens in the event village. The ride itself on the Sunday, either 45 or 100 miles, as I said, starts and finishes in the heart of Birmingham city centre. And there's even a bit of pavé, Lionel, the cobbled roads of Pepper Lane, just alongside Coventry Cathedral, somewhere our colleague Daniel Freeb will no doubt know very well.
Well, Daniel will know those roads like the back of his hand, of course.
Yes, indeed. And you'll own the roads and the ride through the stunning countryside, panoramic views, picturesque villages, and lots of lovely climbs along the way. And as I said, you'll be riding with around 15,000 other cyclists.
That sounds like a peloton that everyone will want to be a part of. And because you listen to this podcast, you can get an exclusive £10 discount on the entry fee. You may have to be quick though, so head to velobirmingham.com and enter the promo code cyclingpodcast. That's all one word, cyclingpodcast, and you can get £10 off your entry and be there on the start line for what promises to be a fantastic weekend of racing. Watch the pros battle for the national titles one day and then ride with a peloton of riders on closed roads the following day.
Well, here we are, Luke. This is our annual classics catch-up. Welcome back to Life in the Peloton, the first time you're here this year.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me back on. Good to be back on.
And it wouldn't be a Life in the Peloton recording without a Belgian beer in hand. So what have you got for us tonight?
Tonight I've got the St. Bernardus. Apparently it tastes the same as Westvleteren.
And it's very appropriate, seeing as we're talking about the opening weekend tonight, the opening weekend of the classics, that is, because we explained this last year, so if you haven't heard this episode, it's really interesting. It's a little bit outdated because we're talking about last year's classics, but go back and listen to 12 months ago, Luke and I talking classics, and you'll get the idea of what we're talking about. But what we do is, the first weekend in Belgium where the first races of the Cobblestone Classics happen, Omloop-het Nieuwsblad and Kerner-Brussels-Kern, it's the opening weekend of the classics, and we just discuss what's going on, being back on the stones and being back in the cold, stressful racing. So that's what we're doing this year, and we're having a Belgian beer. I'm having a Chimay Blue, which
that's
is...
That's your favourite, no?
It's up there. My favourite is Orval.
Orval. Was Chimay for a while there, I think, wasn't it?
No, it's just a good standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get into it. Let's talk about Belgium, because as I've described in the last few podcasts, or if you haven't heard already, I'm not doing a whole lot of Belgium classics this year. Changed my program a little bit, so I've missed opening weekend. And that's what I want to ask you, actually, for my own insight. What was it like? What was it like being back up in Belgium, first of all? Back up in Belgium.
Well, I think there's two sides of it. Maybe you dodged a bullet, missing opening weekend. I think you've done opening weekend enough times to understand what opening weekend is. It's generally one of the worst weather conditions for a classic, because it's the earliest, you know, it's in February still, and we got a classic opening weekend. You know, we did recon 2 days before in actual snow, 1 degree in snow, and the races that we did, Omloop-het Nieuwsblad and Kerner-Brussels-Kern, were done in, you know, very dismal conditions. You know, sort of that weather app we get before the race says 8 degrees but feels like 2. You know, with 40.
What is that feels like?
I don't know. Like, what does that feel? What
do you
mean?
Did it feel like too?
Yeah. It was bloody freezing. So,
What did you wear?
As you know, that is the biggest talked about thing in the bus before. Mm. It's actually quite comical, really. You know, I don't know how many times I've been up in Belgium, but I'm sitting there going, now I have four selections of undershirts. I have three different vests. I have three different rain jackets. I have three different toe covers, all these different things. And you're trying to work out what you need to wear. And then someone comes out of the blue and just wears Nixon jersey. Like, we have this Italian guy in our team, Eduardo Fini. And he doesn't feel the cold. And he comes, he's got just like a light vest, arm warmers, and Nixon jersey. I'm looking at him like, are you putting a jacket on? He's like, no, that's all I'm wearing. I'm like, what do you mean that's what you're wearing? Like, it's freezing outside. He's like, oh, it's not that cold. And I'm like, oh, no. And then the stress
blows
starts.
Everything out. You're like, oh, God.
I've got, you know, a buff on up around my face. And so
what did you wear? Run us through from the bottom to top, well, starting with the shoes.
Yes. Shoes, I don't generally like to wear booties, so I wore toe covers. Amazing creations, toe covers. If you can keep your toes warm, everything else feels warm.
Winter socks.
You know, merino wool winter socks. Then I went knee warmers. The only reason I went knee warmers is because they're easy to get off while you're racing. Leg warmers is a bit more difficult.
They're quite long knee warmers, though.
Yeah, long knee warmers. I actually cut off leg warmers. Then I went, we have a woolen, no, not a woolen, but like a thermal Knicks.
Mm-hmm.
Bib shorts, they call it a ceramic undershirt, which has got some sort of fibre in it that's meant to be warm.
Is it a vest undershirt or is it a short sleeve or long sleeve undershirt?
Short sleeve. Hmm. Yep, short sleeve undershirt. And then set of thermal arm warmers.
Thermal arm warmers?
Yeah, they're like a bit more robust, a bit more, even a little bit waterproof.
Oh, yeah.
There's some really great kit out there these days. and then I went no jersey because there was no actual point wearing a jersey because I was never going to wear it, so I pinned my numbers to a short sleeve thermal jersey.
Really?
Yeah. And then I ran a rain jacket in my back pocket, so at any moment I can put my rain jacket.
Was it raining on the start line?
It wasn't raining on the start line, but sort of 5k in, wore the rain jacket. But the hard thing is with those races.
Last thing, did you wear anything under your helmet?
No, I hate it. Headband or the cap, or you can wear a cap if it's really raining, but anything else just makes me feel a bit claustrophobic. Can't wear a headband or anything. I'd prefer just to.
And you had a buff on?
No, buff. Also the same thing. Don't like it around my neck. Yeah, you know. Yes, it looks cool. I think it looks great. A buff looks great. Like, you look like a sweet dude when you wear a buff, pretty much. But they're the uncomfortable race.
Not long finger gloves either.
No.
Short finger.
Short fingers. Yep.
So, okay, well then run me through, you've touched on the weather a little bit. It was pretty icicle. It was sort of almost sleet, was it?
Yeah, it was really windy. So any weather that came in didn't last very long. It was sort of like 40 to 50 k an hour winds. So sort of like we'd get sort of like flashes of rain, cold, and then it would blow over and then it would come back again. You get a little bit of hope. Oh man, the day's actually not so bad. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's apocalyptic. And then you look up the road and it's sunny again. So it wasn't as bad probably as what we had predicted. But Saturday, yeah, like for me personally, made a massive mistake in terms of I got really cold. So I've gone back and got a jacket and to put a jacket on. And then it's that's the risk, actually. If you go back to the cars in these races, your race ends.
Oh, so what happened to that rain jacket from the start?
I got rid of it because it got warm.
So you threw it away?
No. I went back to the car and gave it to the car. We don't get that many rain jackets to throw them away. But
why? You were thinking it was going to go warm to the end of the day.
Yeah, because it got really warm and it got to that point where you're thinking, I'm like sweating here. And
how many K in?
Maybe 20K. It was like really, really warm.
You didn't think about just pocketing it for later in the day?
Look, I made a mistake, you know.
Let's just break this apart. Let's debrief it.
All right, so debrief. I had this jacket on, I took it off, I gave it back to the car, and then I kept racing. And then it got to a point where it was headwind, it was cold, and it was 140 or 50K to go. The brake's gone. So you're thinking, okay, this is a moment where amateur decision for me, I've raced up in Belgium long enough, you never know when the race is going to kick off. But I've made a decision to go back and get a rain jacket. I've waited for the car to come up. We are car 22, that's also difficult. And the car has come up and given me the jacket, but I knew there was going to be some crosswinds and I made a bad decision. I stopped and put the rain jacket on.
You stopped?
Because it was windy. I don't know what I was doing. And then I got going again, and when I looked up, you know that moment of horror when you look up and you see one team deciding to... and you're actually in car two. You're not even back in the peloton. That was a long 35K of chasing to make the race, get back to the race. So, yeah, I learnt my lesson. It's funny, hey, every time you go up, and that's what opening weekend is, isn't it? It's like you go up there and you're learning about... it's all new again because it's like no other race. You know, the weather conditions, what you wear in the race, how you race. You know, there's some sort of structure about most races, but when you get up there on opening weekend, there is no structure. You really have to be open to any possibility of how the race goes. It could kick off the neutral car. Mm. You've seen that before. As they drop the flag, it splits into four groups, and that's the end of the day.
Again, Wavelgem, many a times.
Yeah, again, Wavelgem. So you really just have to, I think the mentality, you know, you've been racing in the sun in Spain, you've been racing in the sun into it and under, and break goes, it's all pretty good, and then all of a sudden you race in the final and that's it. But up there it's just like all of a sudden like
poof. Well, let's talk about that, the stress, and that's something that I miss, and that's something that always blows me away with opening weekend. You go there with this individual motivation like, yeah, this year's my year.
Tick all the boxes.
I'm going to go up there. I've ticked the boxes. But not only that, I'm fit. That's all done. But the second thing is, no, I'm ready this year. And when, you know, shit hits the fan, I'm going to be that guy who's ready to nut it out. And I'm going to race for that corner and I'm going to be the last guy to break. But every single guy is thinking that.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Every single guy. It's not like
200
guys. Five, six yeah. classics down the road, yeah, where you're like 40, 50 guys are like, you know what?
Maybe this year I'll be different.
Yeah, well, they're like 60, 70 guys are like, I'm over it. Yep. You know, you have the wheel, whatever.
Yep.
But like these guys, the first weekend, and it's the stress. What was that like? Was it still there this year?
Yeah, I think it's a good yes, it was.
Yes.
100%, yes. So in the neutral, it's quite a comical neutral. As you know, you leave Ghent and there's that one corner in the neutral that goes under the bridge. And again, you sort of start left and you come up, you rise over this footbridge and you drop down and you take this right underneath the bridge. And
the freeway. Yeah.
You're still on the neutral car. It's still neutral. Mm. Like, this is the big thing. You're still neutral. And there is guys sprinting over the top of the freeway bridge to make sure they're first into that corner to make them not screwed up for the next three corners. And like, everyone looks at each other and go, right,
we're up,
it's on. Yeah. You know, and then as soon as the car goes, it's just, it's hell and it's war, and there's so many close calls. And the biggest thing is that I always find with opening weekend is that you really need to try and stay calm in it. And I think the guys that do perform on opening weekend have an ability to be able to stay calm in those moments and like just sort of be able to, because it is a stressful situation and there is no other race like it. Like, I mean, the amount of stories that you could share from opening weekend of close calls that you saw or you were a part of are just endless.
But now, does it make you, are you walking away from that Sunday night flying from Brussels back to Barcelona? Were you on that flight going, yeah, so why do I love these things again?
No, not really. I think the first day, sure, I made a mistake with the rain jacket, but the second day there is that love for those races. And once you get in the flow of those races, you sort of, it's a bit like you're going on a ride at an adventure park. You know, you sort of get addicted to that roller coaster.
Mm.
And I think on Sunday, or even after Saturday, on Sunday, I got a bit of addicted to be... There's a bit of a process and a system to the risk, and I love them. Like, I still, when I got on the plane Sunday night, I was like, yeah, I can't wait to get back up here for the next round.
Well, tell me about Saturday night then. What were you feeling? Like, I know the rain jacket, the disappointment of the day.
Yes.
The opening race.
Yeah.
So what was your thought process individually? Okay, what am I going to do tomorrow? How am I going to save this for myself?
Like, Saturday, there's no excuse to make it. Like, it's a silly decision. I've been pro for long enough. There was no excuse to do that. So, but Sunday night, I literally just wrote it off.
Saturday night.
You make a bad mistake, and then, you know, you move on. And then Sunday, you went in the mentality of, rather than overanalyzing or the anxiety of opening weekend or whatever, just, you know how to ride classics, just race the race, you know. what I like to do is break it down into small steps. So throughout the race, there is these crucial sections that you need to be in the front. And that starts from about 30K in. Okay, the first section is the hollow egg, which is a cold section, maybe 2K long. Be top 10 or top 20 position into the hollow egg.
Cut to berg before that, maybe.
Yep, tick that box. Once you ticked it, then you move on to the next berg. Okay, maybe it's Pattersberg, or not Pattersberg, we did Patterstrap, maybe top 10 or top 20 into there. Then relax through this period because it's a long road. Then you really got to break it down all the way to the finish. And I think that's what was like what I did Sunday. Is that how I normally race them? Is that, okay, doom, pick that box, ticked it, move on. Pick that box, tick that, move on. And
opposed to just going, you know what, I want to finish top 10 today.
Exactly.
And thinking about that sprint and thinking about that corner at 300 metres to go.
When the race is over for 100K to go. So, yeah, that was pretty much my mentality, which I knew better and I was a bit upset about it, but that's the way it is, you know.
Well, let's speak about someone who actually seemed to had a good winter and get things right. Jasper Stuyven, who's come out of the opening weekend, I guess, on top of the world. And to rewind back 12 months ago, I remember we were asking who was going well, who wasn't. And a guy that I sort of thought and expected to go really well in the opening weekend was him. And just didn't look like he was on fire. It sort of rolled on for the whole classic season. He wasn't creeping, but he just wasn't doing what I thought.
Mm.
And this year he's done even more than what I thought he could do. Winning Umloop at Nieuwsblad and then the next day actually finishing fifth. So, like, to back it up, two epic races and two quite different races.
Mm.
What were your thoughts on him?
Well, I mean, he had an amazing weekend. I think Trek as a whole had a great weekend. What I did notice from Trek is that they employed, I did say this during the race, actually, to Ryan Mullen, who was riding for Trek that day, was saying that they were riding really, really well. And
what were they riding as a team?
As a team, but not just as a team. They were doing a sort of a similar format to what Quickstep normally do, is that they sort of pick two or three riders to just ride the front at all times during the race, regardless how hard the race is. Your leaders are always never further back than fifth, sixth or seventh wheel. So what they were doing was they would use three guys and their race is over. I'm sure they were using Ryan Mullen, I'm not sure who they were also using, but they were riding the front even into a headwind section on a big road. And they would just be riding, turning it over. And regardless how slow,
Taking control,
which was what Quickstep have done in the past with Elio Kesa, De Klerk, these riders. They would ride the front, take control.
What were Quickstep doing then?
They were doing it as well.
Taking second fiddle.
Yeah, but also they have probably about five leaders. It's very difficult in that team when you think about how many guys, who's actually going to ride the front if you've got Bob Jungels, Stibar, Askren, Yves Lampaert, and the list just goes on. Jakobsen, you know, just who's actually going to ride? That's the difficult thing about Quickstep. They've got so many leaders. So what Trek were doing, which saves Stuyven a lot of energy, is committing. They're not really chasing, but they're establishing
and installing the confidence in him.
Exactly.
Hey, we're here to win.
Yeah. And I think it's very difficult for a Belgian young rider like Stuyven, who had such a great success early on. And I mean, he's a class bike rider, but that pressure builds and builds and builds and builds. If you continually build that team around him, you know, you're bound to have a bad year here and there. So it's obviously he's worked out a way to get his form back to what he can do, and it was bloody impressive, and it was great to see, you know, him back and winning on.
Well, who else did you think was moving well? Because look, I was watching it back here in sunny Spain on television. It's always easy to critique it from the TV. And one person I saw a lot on the camera was Heinrich Hausler, and we know him personally from racing in the worlds together with him. And just to see him back in form, Heino, if you're listening, g'day, mate.
G'day, Heino.
You know, good to see him back in form. And he also, I saw he threw up an Instagram saying, you know, seeing the legs of 2009 again, and that was some pretty special years. And he was, for lack of a better word, taking the piss up front. I would have liked to see him go on and do something a bit more with it, but he's looking like he's back in good form. Who else did you see sort of floating around that didn't necessarily stand on the podium, but you saw, you know what? That guy just rode up the Quaremont from back to front.
Mm.
No one would have seen that, but he's going well. Who else did you think?
Well, I think, I mean, I like the combination with, it's a bit of a shame that obviously Trentin had to to leave our team to
Matteo Trentin. Matteo
Trentin, yeah. But I did think that Trentin-Greg Van Avermaet combination actually worked quite well. Mm. It's always difficult when you have two sort of classic leaders and how they're going to merge together. But it looked like Trentin had super legs for Het Nieuwsblad. He was unlucky not to get back to that group on the Mer. He ended up running fourth, which is a great result. And then Greg...
Because what, in case anyone didn't see what happened there, there was a group that got away, that was away earlier, and he tried to go across solo, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
He tried to go across after the Mer.
Well, which was an amazingly strong move, wasn't
it? Yeah, and he said he did his best time trial power forever when he was by himself for that long period. And I think that's going to be quite a good... you know, I think the biggest thing people can compare themselves is how they're going to rival Quickstep. And that's always what you talk about in the classics, because Quickstep have such a dominance. Like I explained before, they have five leaders. So with teams like Trek going, no, we're going to ride like this, and CCC have, we've got two leaders, we've got Greg and we've got Trentin, and we've got EF has also a great classic squad as well. It's just trying to work out your combinations to try and combat such a strong team. Like,
well, I think like you said, it can actually work in an advantage, because sometimes when you've just got the sole leader, yes, the whole team's behind them, but if that sole leader is isolated on their own, they feel like they've got to do everything on their own. And often you get into the final with one or two leaders who are good enough to make the final. You've got options to play.
Yeah, for sure.
And like, that's something we've spoken about in the years before. And it looks like with Trentin now and Greg can actually use that, and Matteo can also use Greg being there too. And it's just finding that if they can be worked together well.
Yeah, for sure.
Was there anyone you didn't think was going particularly well that you expected to be up there?
What would I think? I mean, I think it's been a big loss for Lotto to lose Tiche to go to Sunweb. I didn't. I actually was riding behind someone. I thought, that looks like Tiche, but I actually forgot he'd gone to somewhere. So I think that's been a bit of a loss. I didn't see Lotto, I guess, up there as much as maybe they have been in the past, when they've got such a threat with, you know, got Tim Wellens and also
John Degenkolb now. They've also got Gilbert back on there. So I guess that team is probably going to come away from that weekend and then be like, we're still a force to be reckoned with, and let's see what happens with them in the next little period.
And I think it's also a big thing not to overanalyze opening weekend, because, well, I don't know if it's correct stat or not, but they said not too many people have won Het Valk or Het Nieuwsblad and then gone and won Flanders, because they're so far away.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that it's like, okay, that's opening weekend. It was a good test for everyone. A lot of people, like even for us in Mitchelton Scott, we had a lot of young guys up there. And some really passionate guys for the classic. Sort of, I saw a lot of kind of you and me when we first used to go up there. And I mean, you've been there a lot earlier than me, but you teaching me the ropes of the classics. And a lot of those guys are coming to me for advice. And we've got a really good young squad up there. But I think opening weekend was one of those scarring but necessary experiences for a lot of teams to have, because in a month's time we go up there and we do the real battle.
Tell us about one piece of advice you gave someone, one of the young guys.
Yes, it was a bit of a funny story. I was speaking to Rob Stannard. He's a young Australian kid, and he loves the classics, and he has a big future up there, I feel.
He was in the final at Kerner.
Yeah, he was 14th. Hmm. It was pretty good.
Just you and him in the final, wasn't it?
Yep. He was up there. And before this was going into...
Sorry, how old is he?
Rob Stannard is, I think, 22, 23. Yes. We get to the run into the Côte de Trieux, which is the climb that you need to be in the front if you want to be in the front for the Quaremont. Because what happens, you go into the Côte de Trieux, you go to the top, everyone rides, blocks the road, it's a really small road, and at the top it's like an all-out sprint to make it into position for the small downhill, which you go downhill, left, left, you're onto the Quaremont.
Mm.
So pretty much if you're out of position on the Côte de Trieux, you can pretty much say, kiss your chances of being in the front over the Quaremont. So Rob had done a really good effort to get into position on the Côte de Trieux, and he was next to me, and we get over the top, and I start yelling at Rob, we gotta go now, we gotta go now, let's go. And we start sprinting, you know, I start sprinting, and Rob sort of...
Was that on that bypass road there?
Yeah, the bypass road, and I've sort of... Rob sort of starts sprinting, and Rob's a much faster sprinter than me, but Rob's sort of just, you know, like semi-going, you know? And I've just sort of, I've come past him.
You're doing 5K
an hour quicker. Just like, mate, oh, we're going to go. Like, we're going to go now.
What position were you guys in?
We might have been 30.
And you're like, we need to be top 10.
We need to be a top 10. Like, we really need to just keep going until we get there, you know? And Rob didn't quite understand the urgency of what, obviously never done the run in to the Quarrumont before, didn't quite understand what was coming up. There was actually no moment. And the next time I got to speak to him after the finish was, he said, oh, when you said go now, I didn't really know it was like all out, full gas, sprint. I just sort of like semi, like got out of seats.
You're like, started, yeah, I know.
No, I know, I saw you. And Rob got tailed off on the Quarrumont and had to chase for 30 or 40K before he eventually came back to me. And then he sort of realised...
You almost want to laugh at him at that point.
He wishes...
G'day, mate. Yeah, hey. Welcome back.
He's, oh, man, that's been a hell of a ride to get back, you know. But, you know, he that's a lesson that I've sort of that he learned, and I don't think he'll do that again.
But that's the thing. You've got to learn the hard way. Yes. So, like, now he knows. Maybe it would have been worse for him to sprint in position and stay there, because he would have been like, Quarrumont, it's not too hard. There's one little point I also want to touch on, which I think most people would have seen, or if you didn't see it, Gianni Moscon is a guy, an Italian rider from Ineos, and he's been a bit controversial over the last few years, and it looks like he's got a bit of a short temper. But typically, back on the stress stuff, it was a very stressful race, and there's quite a lot of crashes just from there's no room on the road. And from what I could see, there was just one of those type crashes. Guys went off the side of the road, spilled off the road, and in an effort to find his bike, he was picking up other bikes and threw his bike at another rider. Once again, I only saw it on the television, so I had no idea of the situation. What was that situation like? Can you shed any light on that, or is it even worth talking about this?
I mean, not really. It's not acceptable at any moment, I don't feel. Like, we are all trying to go to the front, and there is, generally in the classics, there's no hierarchy with... Everyone's actually just trying to get to the front, and it doesn't matter who you are. It's Gilbert, it's a Neo Pro, it's whatever. And you see riders of even really high caliber taking huge risks to get to the front, because it's the you need to be there. And everyone's just trying to do that. And crashes happen because there's 180 guys trying to fit on a road no bigger than a bike path. So when you see someone, there's a crash, and sure, there might have been a guy taking a bit of a risk to move up and causes a crash, but I mean, you don't really know, like, who actually caused it. Most of the time, you would have no idea who actually caused it. It's just not acceptable to pick up your bike and throw your bike at another rider. And if you've seen, like, if we use a Depana last year, 3 days, no, it's only a one-day race, Depana last year, when you see a huge pile-up of crashes... You know, there was a Michael Hepburn, a good friend of ours, you know, stopped, put his bike, took bikes off Zach Dempster, who was laying on the ground, to see if he was okay. Mm. And we're all trying to do a job, and no one wants to see other people injured. Like, sure, I want to beat you into that corner, but I would hate to see that person injured. And I think that's one thing that we all need to realise, that sure, we are racing and it is war out there and it is quite stressful, but I'm taking no enjoyment out of someone crashing into a side of a car or running into a pole or pushing him off the road. So, you know, there needs to be that level of just humanity, really.
I think the point you said there, we are racing.
Yes.
Racing a bike.
It's a game.
Exactly.
More or less, you know. So, not excusable. Mm. I have no time for things like that.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
We'll take a short break from Mitch's conversation with Luke Durbridge to remind you that this episode is sponsored by Velo Birmingham and Midlands. And it's a genius idea to bring the national championships together with an already established closed road sportive, because it's the best of both worlds, isn't it, Rich? The national championships, of course, being won by a who's who of best British riders. In recent years, the men's road race title has been won by Geraint Thomas, Bradley Wiggins, Ian Stannard, Mark Cavendish,
Adam Blythe.
Adam Blythe, friend of the podcast. The women's title by Nicole Cook, Emma Pooley, Lizzie Deignan, Laura Trott,
Hannah Barnes, Alice Barnes,
the reigning champion. And it's a chance to see the established pros and the stars of the future all racing for the national championship jersey. Richard, did you ever ride the Nationals back in the day?
I did, Lionel, but it was a different proposition then. I mean, the national championship in their current format over several days, with the time trial on the Thursday and then the road races on the Saturday, it's really grown an awful lot. And you've now got TV coverage, and you've got World Tour professional riders. That was not that common back in the 90s. The event itself, though, has become a real showpiece event and one that attracts lots and lots of spectators. And again, that's not something that really happened in the past. It's a real treat to watch, partly because you've got this great battle between the domestic professionals who make up the bulk of the field and the World Tour professionals who come back, some of them riding on their own. And that's increasingly the case with British riders, sprinkled as they are around World Tour teams. It's no longer the case that all the British pros are riding for Team Sky, is now Team Ineos. They'll have quite a strong squad. But if you remember last year, Ben Swift won, and there was, I would say, limited teamwork. It was clearly every man for himself. Ian Stannard was away for a bit, but when Swift caught him, he went straight past him. You know, there was no dragging him to the finish for a silver medal.
Well, I think that's something that all of the national championship races have in common. It really is man against man, woman against woman, because there isn't the team strength. So you really see racing at its purest. And I definitely think this idea of having a festival of cycling over a weekend is the way to go. It's always more appealing as a rider, isn't it, to get to test yourself on a course that the top riders have tackled. And well, it's going to be a fantastic weekend. So if you would like to enter the Velo Birmingham and Midlands ride, you can get a £10 discount on your rider entry going to velobirmingham.com and use the promo code cyclingpodcast, all one word, cyclingpodcast.
Great. All right. Well, let's get into some of these questions. So we've got a lot of We've got a lot of listener questions sent in this week. Here they are, the mailbag questions. First off the ranks, we've got Andrew, who sent in a question. What classics are both of you doing this year? What are you and Durbo's goals at the classics this season?
Do you want to start that?
I'll start up, yep, because I'm pretty short this year.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to consider it a classic. I'm doing Strada Bianchi for the first time.
It's a classic. Yes, I agree.
I'm pretty excited about it.
I think you'll like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good race.
It's going to be completely different, and I'm happy to be excited about doing a new race. So after that, I'm dropping into Belgium and doing Dupana, the race we spoke about just now.
Yes.
Then I'm going away, and I'm coming back for Skelder Race, flat race.
Are you racing in between?
I am. I'm doing Sicily, Tour of Sicily. And then, of course, I'm doing Roubaix. So just a little bit, but the best.
You might be a bit of a Matt Heyman sort of setup. Just drop in for Roubaix.
I could do. Could sort of be up there on that podium.
Who knows?
What about you?
For me, I do Milan-San Remo. Another big classic. I haven't done a Milan-San Remo in a few years. And then I pretty much do all the classics, the Flemish classics, from E3, Prize, Gent-Wevelgem, Dwaze d'Or Vlaanderen, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix.
No Skelder Place.
No, we've never done Skelder Price.
Nice. What are your goals?
Goals, I would love to be on the podium in one of the classics coming up. Yep.
The monuments or any classic?
Me. I want to be in the front group racing in that front group racing for the win. And I think now, over the years and experience and the legs that I potentially would like to have, is I would like to be on the podium in some of these, yeah.
Nice. Carl sent in another question. Who is the most respected, feared classic rider in the peloton at the moment?
For me, I would say consistently, you can't go past Greg.
Van Avermaet.
Yep, Van Avermaet. Just because he is always there, and at any moment, he is always trying to go for the win. You know, even Greg runs second or fourth or fifth or third, or it doesn't matter what race you go to, Greg is always in that final and doesn't always work out for him because he's very tagged. But for me, I have a lot of respect for Greg in terms of, because every time there's a race, there's an opportunity, and that's to see how he races.
Well, I think, like, I know he's probably not a feared rider, but maybe he is now. R-Screen, after the weekend...
He is ridiculous.
Like, he is ridiculous, but, you know, is he as crafty as a well-renowned classics rider? I don't know, but at the moment, it doesn't seem like he needs to be.
No.
He's got the horsepower, you know, like Stibar, I think... Zenik Stibar is also...
Last year was a really good year for Zenik Stibar when, in terms of, he'd been away from it for a while in terms of trying to get it right. And then last year I felt he really just, he smashed it last year. And I think the Roubaix or the Flanders is not too far away.
That's from what him. I like about him. He's the double.
Mm.
He's not just a Flemish guy and he's not just a Roubaix guy.
He can be out there in both.
Yeah. Luke J., when did you guys discover the classics? Before or after becoming pro? And did you ever think you were going to be a classics rider? I saw the classics in like a Bicycling Australia magazine, and I always vividly remember seeing this picture of O'Grady on a white cream look with the red look paint.
And Cofidis?
No, he's in Credit Agricole.
Credit Agricole.
And he might have been Aussie champ, and he was going around a corner out of the seat, might have been up the Mer. And I just looked at it and he was dirty and he had the low profile wheels in on the cobbles. And I was like, oh, wow, that looks sick.
Cool. Yeah.
And then I had no idea whether I could be a classics rider or was going to be one. But when I signed with Skill Shimano, my first team, we went and did a recon before opening weekend. Actually, it was pretty gnarly. It was freezing. Now I think about it, the time of year. And I remember hitting those cobblestones, the Quarremont, and I remember saying to the director of the Quarremont, it's my favourite climb. I quickly learned it wasn't my favourite climb. It's like the hardest climb there is.
So hard.
But I just loved everything about it. The challenge of getting up that thing and hitting the stones, and we rode low profile wheels back then with 28 spokes, you know, and everything about it was pretty cool. And that goes back to what I said to you earlier in the pod, is that, do you still love it? There's something weird about those races. They're so friggin' hard. Yet, when I talk about it now...
You can hear it in your voice.
I'm almost disappointed I wasn't up there this weekend in the cold and the rain. So, yeah, that's my answer to that.
I guess for me, when I turned pro, I was more of a time trialist, I would say. I did have this vivid memory of watching Stewie on this dodgy Russian feed on the internet at 2 a.m. in the morning when Stewie won Roubaix.
Oh, yeah.
Running through the house yelling, Stewie's won Roubaix. You know, my parents probably don't even know what Paris-Roubaix was. And I was saying, Stewie's won Paris-Roubaix, first Australian ever. We always used to practice that salute that he did with one hand pointing to the sky and grabbing his seat and pointing to the sky. It was a pretty cool salute. And I guess there was a little bit of burning desire there. I was fortunate enough that when I turned pro, my first classics, my first race in Europe was 3 days of Tapana with Stuart O'Grady in my team.
Mm.
And we went up the Kemmelberg and I hit the bottom with Stewie and I just went for it as hard as I could, you know. Stewie's in retirement, retiring, and he was sort of like in the sort of twilight of his career, and he sort of came and said, oh, mate, you went up there bloody good. And
was this after the race?
This after the race. You know, I think I ended up running, you know, top 10 overall in GC, you know. And he's like, you know, it's bloody great. You went up there pretty good. And I was like, oh, yeah. Then after that, I sort of, you know, I guess I didn't realise that maybe that was something I would be good at. I never really sort of like thought about it so much. And I guess it wasn't until I started really riding with you and understanding the amount of commitment that went in to the classics. And you know, we used to go up there and rent a house in Belgium, and your love and passion for the races, I guess it was sort of, I didn't realize it needed that amount of commitment to actually do something up there. So I probably not wasted, but I probably did 2 years or 3 years of just going up there and racing and getting my head kicked in, and then going on to the next race and trying to do some time trials. And then I sort of thought to myself, well, maybe I actually could do well in these races. And then that's when I started to, you know, really lean on you for advice about going up there and doing the reconnaissance of the courses. And we started going up there in maybe 2015, 2016. And from then on, I've just been absolutely hooked. So, yeah, I've always had a passion for classics, but it probably wasn't like something that started out, because I was just a time trial track rider, I guess.
Mm.
But then as I've gone up there and riding with you and Matt Heyman and Stuart O'Grady and, like, you know, like, now Heyman's my director, like, you couldn't get a much more passionate guy about the classics up there than Matt Heyman, can you? You know, so, yeah, I guess now that's why I'm hooked.
Eric, during the Spring Classics, fans regularly see the peloton race like madmen towards particular obstacles tackled during various races for the sake of position. Of all the classics, cobbles or otherwise, what particular approach to a climb or sector is the most absolute craziest?
This is a good one. What's yours?
It's got to be the Quaramont.
Yeah.
You're coming down they call it the new Quaramont and the old Quaramont. So the new Quaramont is just a normal road that runs parallel to the cobblestone climb, the old Quaramont. And we come down there, like, we do it in Flanders three times.
Remember the year they put us on that?
The little road.
Yeah.
I crashed in the barbed wire.
Yeah, the barbed wire, yeah. That was last year? Year before.
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
And we come down this road. It's probably like 5 or 6%. Big freeway road. And we are flying. Like, I mean, 100K an hour. And there's guys just doing their race-ending peels before we get to this right-hand turn, which is actually still probably 2K away from the climb. But as we've already spoken about, that corner is important before that corner, before you can't move. So everything is backtracking, which makes this descent epic. I've actually considered putting a 55 chainring on just for a 2K sector in a 260K race.
There must be 10 wide trains.
And you've got no gears. And my job's often been to position someone into the bottom of the Quaramont.
55 actually is a bloody good idea.
Yeah, just for that 2K sector. That could potentially win someone the race.
Yeah, 58 even.
That for me has got to be the most. That, and I might be stealing your thunder here a bit, that and the first sector of Roubaix.
The first sector?
Yeah.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's true.
How many risks are we taking in there? There's also, again, the road is not quite as wide,
mm-hmm.
but it's about 3 or 4 wide, and you just got trains.
I don't even bother the first sector.
I know, but you still can't afford, like, if there's a crash or... Yeah. Then you're already on the back foot.
Yeah, true.
All right, what's yours?
No, same. No,
those two?
Yeah, hands down. Yeah, it's not stealing my thunder. It's like Quaramont and... I'd say the one before Arenberg, Wallers.
Wallers. That's gnarly. Before Arenberg.
Yeah, I think that's worse than Arenberg because generally it splits Arenberg's on Wallers. Arenberg's already speed, yeah. So
what about the Cutterberg before the Hullerweg? It's always gnarly between there and you turn left and then... So the Cutterberg's, it's a nothing climb, small stones, so it's really fast. You can actually go out of the seat easily. Afterwards is the Hullerweg, is a pretty, probably the roughest sector in Flanders.
Yeah, one of the roughest, yeah.
But it's the first sector for each day normally.
The first sector of all, like, Quaramont, for sure, in Flanders, for sure. Yeah. It's and especially that year they put us on that goat track before we went around the corner and you crashed into the barbed wire.
All right. Simon B, this is. How would you find upper body strength plays a part in the classics? Is it why these races do tend to be dominated by bigger riders with stronger upper bodies?
So I've got like an idea about this, was that I think there's two different reasons. The upper body strength is necessary because the climbs are so steep, and a lot of the times you actually can't, if you want to attack or you want to do anything on them, you have to get out of your saddle. And if it's 17%, you're literally doing like a bench press when you're pulling on your handlebars. So you have to have sort of strong arms because sitting down, you can't accelerate at the same rate as you can in the saddle. So getting out of your saddle over the top of a 17% or 15% climb, you need good upper body strength. Then the other one is, I find bigger riders can be better at...
But why does that not help in a race like Amstel?
True.
Okay.
Don't know. Yeah. I think you need both. Yeah, okay. I'm sure there's not...
Okay, yeah.
Gilbert still has big arms. And he wins Amstel and Roubaix.
Yeah.
The other one was that a lot of the times, a lot of the cobble classics, the cobbles itself, you cannot get out of your saddle on. So you have to be pushed back on your saddle with a bit of weight on the back of the wheel.
Mm.
And for a smaller guy, this can be more difficult because they have less weight on the rear wheel, which then causes them to be bounced around.
Mm.
So you find a lot of climbers, when they come on the classics or smaller guys, they just get rattled the shit out of. And they can't hold the bike down on the cobble, so the power transfer is different. But if you've got a big guy sitting back on the bottom bracket, he can generate power He's putting a lot of weight on the back wheel, which means the power's going forward, and that's why you see maybe more robust guys doing better in
I generally agree with you, but the only spanner in the works there that really threw me off was Vincenzo Nibali a few years ago in the Tour. And like, I'm 100% agree with you, and I thought that was
why even in Tour of Flanders, I think
I thought that's why I was good at the classics. I had a good style at ride, rode on the stones, I sat behind the bracket well, I could sit in the seat, produce good power. But then a guy like Nibali, and he rode with a high cadence, he was able to do it. I'm like, well, it looks like I don't know anything.
I think that guy is just a freak anyway, so.
All right. Ross, to what extent are the classics riders concerned with their weight or not at all? It's like fat bastards to see as much as they can, pretty much.
I think we're in a weight-dominated sport in any way. Like, we have to be conscious with our weight. Just, it's unavoidable. And obviously carrying anything excess, you can't, you don't ride around with a saddlebag and a pump on your bike, do you, when you race? You don't need any extra weight. It is a fine line between power and being skinny, sure. So that's why maybe classic riders are a bit more robust, because they need more power, short, sharp efforts than you would for an extended period of time on a long climb. But, you know.
Yeah, well, there's still steep climbs there.
Still steep climbs.
Like, you speaking at a climb before, Côte d'Atrio. It's a normal paved road that probably averages, what, I don't know, 10%?
Yeah, yeah.
For about 2K?
Sure.
If you're a fat bastard, you're not getting up that.
No, no. So there's
not with the front. So, yes, you need to have a lot more calories because of the weather often.
Yes.
And that can, we've discussed this in previous podcasts, sometimes you get in this downward spiral where you're not finishing a race because you crashed out. You punch it, you miss the front split, so you're pulling out, you're getting ready for the next race, but you've consumed 5, 10, 20, 30,000 calories.
Yeah, and, you know, at least.
For that race. Yeah, and you're only expending, you know, 500 calories. But you know what I mean.
Yeah,
so that can sometimes, by the end of the classics, you're like, well, I maybe put on, you know, 200 grams.
Yes.
Or 5 kilo. And you're like, how'd that happen? Because you're preparing for these races and you're trying to compensate. You're ready for the big day.
You're fueled and ready, but you maybe shouldn't have a career in nutrition and stuff. Well, aren't you a dietetic?
All right. Catalina, how do you guys prepare for the classics in terms of weather? Do you eat more during the race and recovery after?
Well, you gave a good rendition before.
Well, yeah, look.
No, but yes, in fairness, you do eat more, because it's not just the weather. Obviously, it's freezing outside, so your body's obviously working to stay warm. But also because of the mental side of things, which is something that I didn't quite realise, is that your brain is using a lot of glucose to stay focused. Because these races, you might need to stay focused for 4 out of the 6 hours, or even more, 6 out of the 6 hours of racing. Your brain is actually burning through a lot of glucose that you can't quite measure. So on a power meter on our bikes, pretty much everyone in the peloton rides with the power meter, and you can calculate the amount of calorie expenditure you do via your effort, like your
physical effort.
Your physical effort. But in terms of the classics, you might come in and you might have only burnt maybe less than you might have done on a training ride for 6 hours, but you are exhausted because you have used so much.
The extra elements.
Elements.
You've got the cobbles, we spoke about it.
Yep.
Bouncing across a cobble track, being in freezing conditions.
Yes.
And the stress that we spoke about. And another good race to think about that is, it doesn't get the rap of the classics, but it's a race like Paris-Nice. It's a very, very stressful race. It's a stage race, but you need to be prepared for everything. And you need to, and you finish a stage, it's like a flat stage with crosswind. Any other race in the year, you'd be like, yeah, it'd be a hard stage, whatever. But suddenly you get in the bus, you're like, I'm absolutely rinsed.
I'm starving. And then the cycle starts again.
Is it the cold weather? But it is, I think that's a big thing that gets underestimated. Mental aspect. And with the classics, yes, it is important for the recovery straight after the race, because you are racing another completely body-emptying day
two days later.
Yeah, 2 days. So. All right, Brendan, I know riders have to pee sometimes during races, and they often do so on the bike. Are riders doing this in most races, or is it more or less once or twice a season type thing?
No, sorry. I think at least once per race you would stop and go to the bathroom.
It's a pretty rare race.
Unless you
don't piss.
Kilometre zero, you've found yourself in the break. That's one of my biggest fears. What do you do?
I've actually known breaks to actually go, you know what, let's just have a piss.
Actually, I found myself in a breakaway with Matt Heyman once. Two up, Torino, 220K, just me and Heyman in the same team. Only two guys in the breakaway. And the peloton was coming back and we thought, actually, you know, bugger it. Let's just stop for a piss. Because, you know, they don't want the breakaway back because then the attacks start again. So me and Heyman, just both two teammates, stopped on the side of the road.
Had a piss.
Had a piss and got going again.
And the peloton stopped chasing.
Yeah, because they were like, oh, no, we're catching these guys. We don't want anyone to go attacking again. So the sprint team sat up. But no, at least once a race, can you piss on the bike?
I can, but I rarely do it. I've probably done it like five times ever.
It's very difficult because you don't want to. You know, there's always spectators, especially in Belgium. You know,
but on another note, I actually enjoy stopping. Yeah, I enjoy unclipping, having that moment of going, oh, all right, here we go. Let's get ready for the next bit.
I don't mind pissing on the bike in terms of if there's no people around, I wouldn't mind pissing on the bike because I don't actually like coming through the cars because coming through the cars can be quite dangerous.
All right, moving on. Michael, we all have our favourite monument, but which is your favourite semi-classic? I define a semi-classic as an early season one-day race like Samin, which is my favourite race. Samin. Well, it's actually on today, Samin. I've recorded it. We should watch it after.
Let's watch it after, yeah.
Can't wait to watch it.
Yep.
It's my favourite. No, it's not my favourite. I actually only done Samin once. All right, what's your favourite semi-classic?
Do you count Dwars Door as a semi? World Tour now, isn't it?
No, it's not now. It used to be my favourite semi.
That would have been my favourite semi, Dwars Door.
We don't. The problem with us is now we don't do many small races.
No.
Not because we don't want to, but the team just don't do them. I'd love to do a race like Samin or 3 days of West Flanders was a great race, but we just don't do them.
Yeah, semi, the classic I could only say is, yeah, I don't think we do too many. So
De Panna.
We don't do that. Well, we don't do that anymore either.
Don't you do that?
That used to be my favourite, sure.
One day, you don't do...
Well, when Dwars Door, when De Panna was 3 days, hands down my favourite. When it became a one day.
I used to love Dwars of Vlaanderen because, which is also called Waregem. What's the official name of that? Dwars of Vlaanderen.
Dwars of Vlaanderen, yeah.
Because it was a race in between the big ones and a lot of big riders didn't do it.
Because it was close to San Remo. So if the guys did San Remo, it was also difficult to back up and do Dwars Door.
And I used to always see as a little opportunity for myself to try and put a result in. The levels are slightly lower, but it was still all the name climbs.
Yeah, and it was a good course. You
it's
know,
a great the, course. A
great course, you know.
But unfortunately now that's World Tour and everyone just goes to win it. So it's
and they
really
moved
hard.
It as well. Now it's after Gent-Wevelgem.
Yep.
So, yeah, I'm just going to go with Dwars Door, but it's not a semi-classic.
All right, let's talk some tech now. Jay Vinny has got a question for us. What different tech modifications do you use purely for the classics?
Double bar tape.
Do you double up or you always double?
No, I always double.
Yeah, I always double. Yeah. But I doubled for my first year and I've never gone back.
True. What do you call the, do you run the classics button underneath?
If we want that, we have to buy it. So I haven't done it.
I have this fight with the climbers. They reckon it's called a climbing button.
So yeah, to explain to everyone who doesn't know what that is, the Di2 have made this button that sits on the top part of your bars where if you want to sit on the tops and ride the cobbles, you can still change the gears without going to your levers. And like you were saying, the climbers want to sit up there when they're climbing. I think it was originally made for the classics.
I've always said it's a classic button, but then the climbers go, what do you mean? What's the classic button? No, that's the climbers button. I'm like, yeah, is it? So it's a bit of an argument between...
Do you run that?
Yes, always.
Always?
Always. Even all year round.
All season?
All year round, yeah. I maybe don't use it as much as I do, but I sometimes sit in an aero position and hold on to the Garmin mount. And it's great, so then I can just change the button without actually taking my hands off to go to the sides.
Nice. Simon, again, maybe a different Simon, I'm not sure. How do you feel about the disc brakes in the classics?
What I will say, the noise is horrendous. The first corner into the Harhook this year was deafening because of the rain as well. But what I will say is I felt there was less crashes due to disc brakes, because what has happened before in the past, sure, there might be someone crashed. Crashes are going to happen in these races. That's the reality. But the people behind now can stop and react. So there might be one or two people crashing, not 15 people crashing, because a lot of the time it's the guy coming from behind that has no option to stop. The stopping capacity on a disc brake is so much better. But
especially in the wet.
But there is still some work to be done with rubbing and noise and a lot of other things that still need to be worked out. But they're on their way, and I feel like it's kind of the future, yeah.
Aside from the braking side of things, I like the clearance now. And what I mean by that is when you had the caliper brakes, you were restricted to a certain tyre width you could run because it would just rub on the brake calipers. Now the disc brake being lower on the fork, you can have a tyre width that the frame can hold. So you can just have a wider frame and you can have a better clearance. And I'm seeing now, we just use a bigger tyre all year round.
Yeah.
We're using 20, 25s to 28s all year round.
I'm not a fully converter, like in terms of certain things about it. There needs to be a lot of work done about how to remove the wheel for changing. You know, changes are a lot slower, and that's the reality of it. If your bike's in the middle of the car, has to be taken off, your race is nearly over. So there's a lot of still development.
The skewers. They need to do something with the skewers.
Yeah. So, but for, in terms of braking capacity and in terms of how they go in the wet and things like that, they were, I would say they were saving a lot of crashes than not.
Nice. Tommy, how easy do riders adjust to the classics equipment? Is it easier to make a transition to a classics bike these days? And do you even notice a difference?
They're generally the same bike now.
Yeah.
It's no difference.
We're not running the Roubaix bikes anymore because of that fact that I said. The Roubaix bikes in the previous years used to have
bigger clearance, yeah.
Well, they used to run the, what are the brakes called? The V-brakes, mountain bike brakes. So you could have clearance for bigger tyres.
You've been pro longer than me, mate. I never ran a V-brake.
So we used to have them. And you'd have a specific bike for Roubaix because it had different brakes, V-brakes on it. But now we've got disc brakes. You don't need to run a different bike because you can have a 30mm tyre on, or even more. I've even been riding a 33 on my bike.
And the bike itself, they're so complete now that the absorption on the cobbles and they tick so many boxes. They're aero. They're also comfortable. The geometry, like the work that goes in from all the bike brands about trying to make it a complete bike is so big that you don't necessarily have horses for courses now. You've literally just got a horse for everything, you know.
Kate, what happens to riders who abandon a race? How do they get back to the team bus? Does it get packed in team cars during these races where so few finish? So does it get full in the team cars? Well, you're pretty lucky to get in a team car these days. I've never been in it. I've been in a team race car once.
They let you in.
It was a second race car, and I pulled out of the Vuelta, and the car was following me and only me.
Okay.
And so eventually I was just like, oh, I've got to get in the car.
Okay.
And so they had to. The thing is, what people mightn't realize is there's nowhere to put your bike because the top of the car's got enough room for every spare bike.
It's full.
So your bike has to actually fit in the car. When the car's really full, it's got an Esky in the back, it's got rain bags.
What'd you do with your bike?
They put it in with a mechanic. Like it just fits in like...
next to him.
Yeah, like squeeze in the back seat. But in any other race, you won't do that. And in a classic, the classics are quite different because you pass a lot of helpers, either soigneurs or people just feeding you throughout the course. We have like maybe 50 points in a race. It seems ridiculous, but we got bottles on every climb, every second corner, there's people there. So if you're not feeling that good, it's actually a bit of a carrot.
I would say it's sometimes one of the worst places to pull out, because like what happened is on the weekend, like on Saturday, I punctured again and on the Harhook, and then Hayman's like, okay, just shut it down, you know, save it for tomorrow. So I was there and Alex Edmondson was with me as well, and we started riding and we started get going, and we're just sort of trying to work out, like, okay, now where's Nienhoven? We got no phone. You got your Garmin on you, but if it doesn't have maps, you don't know. And lucky Alex Edmondson spent a fair bit of time in Belgium. He's like, I think it's near Brakel. I was like, oh, it's near Brakel. Yeah, okay. So we turned around, rode on the bike path. I'm talking for 15K or so. All of a sudden, we see Sam Bewley pop up out of the Valkenburg. Hey, boys, do you wear Nino over? And like, so Sam Bewley is also a teammate of ours. And he pulls over to me and he's gone, yeah, I think it's near Brakel. So then we're all like, we're trying to like work out on our Garmin to where we got to go, and we ride to Brakel. We get to Brakel. Ah, there's a sign of Nienhoven. Oh, it's 15K. So we'd already ride like 30K, and then all of a sudden there's another 15K to Nienhoven, and then we rode to the final.
And like, the race gets, you know, the worst is the race gets there before you. We should just stay on the race route.
I think there was a funny story. We lost one rider once, and he just went to a house and just sat there, and they tried to work out the, you know, in Belgium, always someone knows something to do with a bike race, called someone who called someone who called someone, and eventually got ahead of our director, Lorenzo Lepage, and then they came and picked him up, and he was just in his house. So it's pretty funny, because as soon as the race is finished, it's open road.
Mm.
You know, you are literally in traffic. Like, just behind the sour wagon, there's a car behind.
I'd almost say it is good advice to give a young guy, learn the roads in Belgium, learn where certain towns are, but it is also crap advice. Because what does that mean? You're going to maybe pull out of a race and you have to find your way home. So maybe you should say never learn your way, because that means you can never pull out of a race.
I think what they should do is a bit of a gift pack. So as soon as the DS like goes past you, if you've pulled out of the race, he just throws this gift pack out to you, and maybe in there's a like a phone, maybe like some sort of first aid kit or something like that.
I've been given the advice.
A burrito.
I think when my wife was pregnant last year, I was doing a few races in the classics where we weren't sure if I was going to get the call. And one of our soigneurs suggested to me, put €50 underneath your sole in your shoe. At any moment, if you get the call through the radio that your wife is going into labour, pull over, hail a cab down and get the cab straight to the finish.
Is there cabs in the convoy?
Well, once you go back to the normal.
Yeah, I know what I mean.
But I was thinking, hang on, why haven't I done that ever before? Like,
it's not a bad idea.
You know, like on those trips home, you can stop at a cafe, maybe get a couple of beers on the way back, make it into a bit of a road trip.
For sure.
All right, let's move on to the next one. But more or less, yes, it can be a bit of a hassle getting back to the finish. What do most guys do between race weekends during the classic season? Recover, train, etc.? Well, it's not normally a weekend. It's actually every second or third day.
Mm.
Run me through quickly your routine. So, for instance, you've got Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday. The following Wednesday will be Dwars de Vlaanderen, and the following Sunday will be Tour of Flanders. Run me through what you think you would do that week.
That week would be not too much. You would do Sunday Gent-Wevelgem, generally a massive 6,000 calorie day, lots of stress. So Sunday night, good meal. Monday would be quite an easy ride. 1 hour, 2 hours.
Coffee shop,
down the Skelder, just spinning your legs out. Then Tuesday would come round, and I actually like to get behind the motorbike. Not hard at all, but just to sort of spin the legs out a little bit longer, make that ride probably 2 hours, and do some sort of openers. Now, what I mean by openers, you might choose between 5 and 10 minutes where you progressively step through heart rate zones up to sort of your maximum, just to sort of open the body up so it's not asleep. So you're not asleep when you go to sleep. When your body has a big effort, it can tend to shut down and go into a sort of a safety mode, more or less. So you just need to open those zones up that you're going to do in the race, and that's pretty much it. In terms of nutrition, you would big meal Sunday night. Monday, you would sort of keep it quite normal, in sort of normal eating. You don't need to overeat on the Monday. And then Tuesday, you'd start to reload the glycogen stores in your muscles for the Wednesday, and in the same recipe.
Repeat. That was from Brian, and we've got a couple questions left. Beth, how is the peloton reacting to the coronavirus? Look, I think you mentioned this to me before the podcast, that obviously it's in the news now. There's quite a lot of stuff happening with coronavirus in Italy, and we were waiting to hear if the races were going to go ahead. And look, I think Everyone's just not knowing really anything about it, so I'm not going to go out on a limb.
No, I just don't think like anyone knows about anything. Like yeah. It's nothing to do with just racing. It's to do with everything, you know, travel or events coming up or people are cancelling this, people are cancelling that. People are just a level of uncertainty, and I think the uncertainty affects our sport because we travel so much and we're bringing a variety of people from different places to one space, which is obviously not what you want when there's a pandemic going on. So I guess you can't, we could talk about, you know, hypotheticals for a long time about it, but we just got to act like business as usual. And we have great medical staff, my team, your team, generally UCI and all the pro teams. And I'm sure they're having much more of a headache about what to do. So we just kind of got to soldier on more or less. But in answer to the question, yes, it is having an effect. It's not having an effect on us per se, but there is, you know, our safety is getting discussed a lot about what's going on at the moment. Yeah.
But do Aussies sometimes miss the extra support of a home crowd while racing the classics?
I mean, it'd be nice, but there is actually a lot of Aussies that come over, sure. No?
I discussed this with, I don't know whether I said this in the podcast, but I was discussing this in Australia. I find it funny racing in Australia. And I don't know, I think it's because I haven't done it my whole career that I don't necessarily, it's going to come out wrong, I don't necessarily love it. Because I do love the support, but I've got used to having no support. So, and not understanding what people are saying. So I get in my zone and I just race. Yes, I can hear the noise of the crowd, but I can't understand what they're saying. And sometimes I find that really distracting in Australia.
I ride
up a climb or something and I can actually hear what this person's saying. They might be like,
come on, Mitch, give it to her. Like,
yeah, or Jesus. And there's a difference in come on. There's come on, Mitch, get into it. Or come on, mate. Jesus.
I'm sure they don't say that.
Give it some. You know, so there's a difference
there. Who ate all the pies?
Yeah. So, and like that actually like distracts you for like 2 seconds. But so I've got used to racing with no support, if that sounds funny, and you just get about your business. The crowds give me energy because of the energy they put into it. Just sure. The yelling and, you know, the...
Like, come on, Mitch. Yeah. And you're like, oh. There you go. Hello, Mitch. And you're like, oh, thanks, mate.
And it's cool when someone yells your name. And yeah. I definitely, my ears do prick when I hear my name in Europe. So that's quite cool. Got my own fan club now in Belgium.
Yeah, you do. So you got to get used to the old support because... The podcast is doing wonders for the old support for Mitch.
I don't think it had anything to do with the podcast. It's just purely my writing ability.
Sure it is.
All right. Harrison, boys, if it came down to a two-up sprint at Roubaix between the two of you, who would win?
Mitch.
Yeah, I think, look, yeah. If it came down to a sprint, and if it wasn't going to be a sprint, I could probably just ride away anyway.
Oh.
I think if it came down to a sprint...
You would win.
What would you do? If we rolled into the track...
Together?
Yeah.
Oh, this is quite a funny... I don't have many options, okay? To set the scene, Mitch is a lot faster than me because Mitch used to be...
But am I, though, at the end of Roubaix?
Yeah.
Like, potentially, you've got through Roubaix easier than me being with a bigger engine.
Sure.
So you're fresher at the end?
I think if I've left it to the velodrome, I've made a mistake.
But look, let's look at Heyman's win. Yes. Would you say Heyman's a better sprinter than Tom Boonen?
No. True.
But what happened? He let it out.
True.
Boonen couldn't even get off his wheel.
True. So just I'd lead it out and you couldn't get off the wheel then.
But would I let you lead it out?
Yeah, we could go after back
watching,
and forth.
After watching Heyman, I'm going back on the old never lead Roubaix out.
I would, like, I've always had this thought, like, maybe I'd use the track more. So, you know,
stay up high.
Yeah, you always see, but it's actually not that steep. But yeah. Just maybe doing it inefficiently. But, you know, maybe I'd do like what I do in a points race when I was back on the track. I'd drop down, do a semi-sprint down the back straight. So the guy's sitting in there ready, thinking that you've done your sprint as a lead out.
And then we
wait
on
to the
hip.
Bend,
yeah.
Comes up, then open up properly.
Would you be that clear-minded, though?
Probably not.
Yeah, that's what I'm just thinking.
But in my dreams, all right, Mitch, this is my thought I've been having, so... You got my tactic. There's my tactic. Hey.
I could potentially see you, we come on the track and you just going.
Oh, just going. Yeah. Two out.
Yeah, just like two out and just like gapping me by like 30 metres. And I'm like, oh, I can't actually close the gap. I'd be so sad if that's how it ended.
We just do a rock, scissors, paper, I reckon, in the end. So, all right, you have it. We can both salute.
All right, the last question from Nick. What's the beer choice for a post-race? Let's keep it classics wise. So we're up in Belge.
Yep, Orval.
Yep. Yep. Orval, that's simple. Orval. Sorry, it was a bit of a...
dead heat.
Well, guys, thank you very much for listening. I hope we haven't lingered on too long. Derbs?
Cheers, mate. Thanks for having me on. Cheers, enjoyed mate. Being back here and talking the classics. I can hear in your voice, mate. You might need to come up for a few more.
I'm happy with my three. And I'm going to be just popping up on the podium in those three, and that'll do.
Exactly. We'll see you on the velodrome then, I guess.
See you, mate.
Well, Mitch, the first thing I've got to say about that is to find out that your favourite Belgian beer is also my favourite Belgian beer, Orval.
Well, that's not a surprise because it's the best beer out there. I tell you what, like, if you haven't tried one of them, anyone out there, go and find it out. If you're not in Belgium, it'll be a bit harder to find, but I'm sure you can find it. And get one of those, sit down, get the right glass and enjoy that. Listen to this podcast. Go back and listen to the podcast again if you didn't have one already, because it's a brilliant beer.
It is. I like that you say there, get the right glass, because that's so important. Drinking the right beer out of the glass that's made to go with the beer. Orval, anyone listening out there, if you want to search for it, it's Orval. And something that I didn't know until I went over to Flanders a few years ago was that actually it's not a Flemish beer. It's from the Walloon area of Belgium, albeit right over on the west side of the country. And it started as a beer that was brewed by the monks. And I don't know whether this is still the case, but there's a kind of a slight urban legend about this beer that the brewery only releases a certain number of bottles of it in a monthly period. So if you basically bars run out of it, so once it's gone, it's gone. But I don't know whether that's something that I've been told, and I've been too foreign and gullible to not work out that they're pulling my leg. I'm not sure.
it is true, because it's quite difficult to get. It's right down near Luxembourg, actually. It's quite a fair way down. I've never been there, but I would love to go. It's an amazing abbey down there. But if you now go into any bottle shop in Belgium, and even the supermarkets don't stock full cases, because Orval's one of the only beers that I know of that you can actually age, and it gets better with age, a little bit like a wine. It obviously increases in price as well. So you can buy in a Belgian bar an Orval that year, which is probably about, I think, 3 or 4 euro. I can't remember off the top of my head. And then the next year, if it's aged for 1 year, is about 7, and it just keeps doubling. You know, there's about 14 or 20 euro bottle of beer, which is quite expensive in Belgium. And what people were doing is they were just going into bottle shops and buying cases and cases and cases, aging them, and then selling them online. So it's difficult to get, because they were like, you know what, if you're really going to drink it, buy it. But if you're going to just age it and sell it, they weren't selling it to people like that. So when I went up there and was trying to transport some back to my home in Spain, I was trying to get a case, but I couldn't get my hands on a case until I sort of had to fly the old I'm a professional cyclist flag. And then magically a case appeared.
Shameless. Absolutely shameless. I don't blame you. I mean, it sounds like a great investment opportunity, but the problem is not drinking it before it accumulates some value. That would be my biggest challenge. I really enjoyed the questions from the listeners there, but it was a real relief for me that you professional cyclists have the same quandary about what clothes to put on when the weather is cold or very cold. The difference here, though, is when I go out cycling, if I get my clothing selection wrong, I'm just out. I'm cold. You know, I've not brought the right gloves. I've not brought the right jacket. Whereas you can just drop back to the car and collect whatever you need. I mean, you know, you've got it easy, really.
You make that sound so simple. But I tell you what, as Luke explained, going back to the car at the wrong time in the race can be the end of your day. And I was quite surprised to hear that he went back for his rain jacket. And as you heard me say, why didn't you just put that in your pocket? Because once you get your position in the Belgium Classics, taking a piss, taking your rain jacket off, even
going out of the bunch to get a bottle sometimes is detrimental, and you don't want to lose one position or even five or half a peloton, you know, God forbid if you take the corner on the wrong side. So going back to the car is sometimes a deathly decision, and you got to be really cold and really want it to make that call.
The other thing I was chortling about was that I just assumed that the old school thing of putting double layers of handlebar tape on for the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix was kind of an old school thing, but you still do that.
I don't know if many guys get it wrapped for Roubaix specifically on the day, but all I know is Durbo and myself, I think a few others, once you go double, you don't go back. It's sort of this thing. And I know another guy, David Miller, he also used to have double or triple rolled. And it's something about that feeling. And once you get that, you know, bar tape's a very specific thing. And there's good mechanics who can roll it really well. And there's mechanics who just put it on. And there's a big difference in my book about who puts my bar tape on well. And it comes down to the two rolls. Once I did two rolls back in the day with my first Roubaix, I think, I just went, you know what? I might just leave this on. So I'm not too sure how many people really get it put on specifically for the day anymore. I think that is true. It's a bit of an old thing. But there's a few guys in the peloton that roll two rolls of bar tape all year long.
It sounds like it's the sort of thing that is as personal to a cyclist as a tennis player's tennis racket grip or a golfer's golf club grip. Once you get it right, that's how you want it.
Yeah, it's exactly the same, I think. But some guys are not that fussy with that, you know, and they just have one layer on there super thin, and it's got to be taped to the exact spot for me before the head stem connects, even on each side. You're looking down at it all day. It's just one of those things that you can see and feel with your hands and notice. So I'm probably sounding like a really prima donna right now, but I guess we all are.
No, I get that. I get that. If it's slightly wrong or the gaps aren't quite even on both sides of the stem, that's the sort of thing that would drive you wild if you're on the bike for 200K.
Yeah, exactly. So it's one of those little things and the classics. And I did love hearing Durbo talk about the classics button. That's something for me I thought was a bit of a gimmick. And, you know, I got over that after one or two years and it just wasn't necessary for me. But, you know, Durbo, he's pushing on with it. Good to see. And that discussion, that continual discussion, is it a climbing button? Is it a classics button? Even though it was developed for the classics, I love how the climbers have tried to adopt that.
I think that's one that no one's going to ever win that argument, are they? But one other thing that really leapt out at me was just hearing from, well, both of you talk about the disc brake bikes, because I've been watching Paris-Nice on TV and this is just my sense, but last season it felt like maybe 50-60% of the bunch were on disc brakes. Watching Paris-Nice this week, it feels like it's much closer to sort of 85-90% of the peloton are now riding disc brake bikes. And one of the things that we don't really get from the TV coverage is that sense of the noise they make as everyone's approaching a tight corner.
Yeah, they really do howl. And I get the feeling over the years they've got better and better. I'm talking about the last two or three years. In the first year, they were really howling a lot and squealing. And we've all learnt how to bed the brakes when you first get them. There's something we weren't aware about in the beginning, and we're just using fresh brakes straight up, braking really hard at the start, which in turn makes them squeal a lot. It's just one of those things that you sort of take for granted, I guess, watching TV and all those little noises and things that go on in especially in a classics race. That's what you can't see. And I always advise people, if you're going to go and watch a race and you can choose any race in the year, you've got to get to Belgium. You've got to see those classics races, because the cobblestone races, that is where racing's at. I'm not saying the Tour de France isn't good to watch or the Giro, but they're different. The classics, 95% of those guys are racing with everything they've got, and you see it in their eyes. You can feel it on the side of the road, and you can feel it with the fans. And that comes down to all those noises. And like Durbo and I were talking about, racing for that corner, it's just an amazing part of the season and amazing racing in this part of the season.
What's your situation with disc brakes? Are you a convert? Do you ever switch between one and the other?
No, the only bike we don't have on disc now is the time trial bike. So we don't have that option anymore. We did have that option with our climbing bike last year, but now our new climbing bike has got disc brakes. So we've got a sprint bike with disc brakes, a climbing bike with disc brakes, and the time trial bike has rim brakes.
And how do you feel? Were you eager to swap over?
Initially, I wasn't. I think like 90% of the people were just like, what they knew was calipers. And I think what converted me was this new bike we have, the it's called the Super 6 Evo. And I was actually riding it a hell of a lot off-road this year in the gravel, and I had some 31 millimeter tires on it. And I suddenly was like completely converted. I was like, this bike is an everything bike. I can ride this off-road. I can race on this in sprints. I can climb on this in the hardest races in the world tour. It was a super lightweight bike, aerodynamic, and with that clearance from disc brakes and the power of the disc brake, I could go and ride gravel. So I was like, I think I hate to say it, but I'm converted. It's been really positive, I have to say. You know, I was looking for something to pull it down, the disc brakes, but at this point, I'm enjoying them.
Well, Mitch, it was really interesting listening to you and Luke talk about opening weekend. I'm just hoping as we sit here now that it doesn't end up being closing weekend for the Classics this year. But I guess nobody can really say what will or won't be on. I guess all your plans are up in the air and you'll just have, like the rest of us, have to watch and wait and see what travel plans are possible and what events go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's right. But I do know there's one thing that's going to always go ahead is the podcast. And something that I've mentioned to you is that it's given me more time to plan and think about good guys I want to get on the podcast, have some good recordings. So there's going to be some good podcasts coming up in the next few weeks. Make sure you stay tuned. But especially stay tuned. I've got this new little series coming up on the Life in the Peloton feed. We're going to call it Talking Luft. It's a little 10-minute snippet. Go around to my original handle, Life in the Peloton. Have a listen to that. It's a cheeky little thing in the alternate weeks. The Life in the Peloton episodes, as you know them, are still going to be here on the Cycling Podcast, as always. And then in the alternate weeks, we're just going to have a little 10-minute segment just to keep you in there and enjoying some more Life in the Peloton episodes. So guys, until next week, listen out for Talking Luft. I'm Mitch Docker, and this is Life in the Peloton. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.